Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's Runner's World podcast with me, Ben Hobson. And I'm sadly all alone for the intro, but do not despair as our guest this week is Dr. Andrew Jones, who offers some amazing insight into how some of the greatest marathon runners of all time prepare and train. But before we get into that, I'm going to tell you about an exclusive listener offer that we have where you can subscribe to Runner's World magazine today and get 3 issues for just £5. Just visit hearstmagazines.co.uk/runnersworldpodcast.
Guest of the week. Sometimes on the phone, could be an athlete, could be a physio, or a complete unknown.
Dr. Andrew Jones has worked alongside the world's greatest marathon runners. He helped guide Paula Radcliffe to a record-breaking run and also with Eliud Kipchoge on the Breaking 2 project. Now he's attempting to run his own marathon feat to break the 3-hour mark age 50, and he's here to talk about all things 26.2. So, Andrew, welcome to the Runner's World podcast.
Thanks very much, Rick. Nice to be here.
Could you first give us a sort of brief overview of your professional background?
It kind of started with me as a sort of talented and reasonably successful junior runner. And like a lot of people, I think, because I was somewhat self-coached and I was just became fascinated in the science that underpinned running performance. So the obvious place for me to go and study, or the obvious subject for me to do, was sports science. So like a lot of runners, I went on to do sports science. And then, you know, again, like a lot of runners, once I went to university, my various injuries and illnesses came along. The running went a little bit by the wayside, but I continue to be fascinated by physiology in particular, by, you know, what is it that enables some people to run faster than others and how we can make people run faster if that's what they want to achieve. So, you know, that led me to do a PhD in exercise physiology. And then I just became sort of fascinated by researching in it. And, you know, having that link with sport was always very important to me as well. So as well as doing the sort of more sophisticated lab-based work, trying to discover what the mechanistic basis is to athletic performance, I was always keen to apply that knowledge to help athletes run faster. So kind of live a bit vicariously through some of the athletes that I supported over those years.
What is it that about the speed element of running, this chasing sort of the fastest times? Is that, what was it that, was that from your personal experience of just trying to better yourself, or was it just that the idea of getting the human body to move as quickly as possible is what really sort of like captured your imagination?
Yeah, I think a bit of both. I've always, you know, that question that you have in the pub after you've done a training session, would you rather be, you know, win the Olympic gold medal or set the world record? I was always the latter. I always thought, well, you know, you can win an Olympic gold by beating the people who are there on that particular day, and that's obviously no mean feat, but to be the fastest athlete of all time at a given distance, I thought was something special. And of course, eventually it might be beaten, but at least for that period of time, you can say you were the fastest athlete that ever lived over that distance. So that kind of appeals. And as scientists, I think we're fascinated by just how fast people can run. And I think when it comes to the 100 meters or the mile, you know, those races are run so frequently that we're probably approaching what the limits are. But clearly with the marathon, there are so many, you run the marathon so infrequently, and the courses on which the marathons are typically run aren't necessarily ideal. And when the best athletes do get together, it's often in a major championship. So the goal is to win rather than to run as quickly as possible. So again, you know, when it came to the Breaking 2 thing, it really was about, you know, people have run under 10 seconds for 100 meters. They run under 4 minutes for the mile. was it humanly possible to run sub two? And of course, we showed, well, Eliud Kipchoge showed that it was. But yeah, those ultimate limits in terms of how fast can people run and what is it that prevents them from going faster is what continues to fascinate me.
I mean, you mentioned Kipchoge there, and I mentioned Paul Radcliffe in the intro. I mean, you have worked alongside very, very closely with, yeah, some of the world's greatest marathon runners. Could you give us an insight into, I mean, I'm sure you've learned lots and lots being, you know, working with them, but what are some of the major takeaways that you've taken away, maybe that other people who aren't quite as talented at running can, you know, put into their own training?
Yeah, well, first of all, they are physically, you know, phenomenal. There's no question about that. You have to have the underpinning physiology if you're going to attempt to run, you know, those sorts of achievements. But they, you know, there are probably other people who are similarly physiologically talented. What you also have to have is the psychology as well. And I don't necessarily mean in the race itself. Clearly, you have to have the confidence, the motivation, the ability to hurt yourself during the race. But it's really the patience to have the longevity, especially when it comes to something like the marathon, because you might not hit your very best until you're maybe in your early to mid 30s. And you might have actually shown your early promise maybe as a teenager, like both Paula and Eliud. So that means you've got to train for about 15 years. And we all know how hard running is. Basically, perhaps as many as 10 or 12 times per week, every week for 15 years consecutively. And that's tough, you know, and it means that you have to get everything else right, because you're training and you're recovering, and you really have to sacrifice a lot. So it's that that monk or nun-like status that you have to kind of buy into if you're going to achieve what you're ultimately capable of in the long term.
We talk about the sort of the backlog of effort that gets into these results, and that sort of coincides with sort of technological advances. And there's lots of debate around the influence of footwear currently now and those sorts of things. What do you think, what's your take on the impact that things like carbon fiber plates and shoes has made on these sort of record-breaking times?
Yeah, I mean, you can't factor that out, can you? There's no question that, like in a lot of sports, there have been technological enhancements over the years, and this is one of them. I'm one of the camp that believe that you can't really suppress that kind of evolution. You know, they're still phenomenal athletes, and the times that we've seen Kipchoge and others run isn't just about the shoe, but clearly the shoe has assisted in that. But there have been various other things that have happened in our sport over the years and in other sports as well, and you just got to kind of roll with it, really. I think to try and prevent that isn't very forward looking.
No, I think you're right. I think that there's always going to be, until everyone is told that they can't wear shoes, then I don't feel like there's any way of stopping the technological side of the sport. And that falls into nutrition as well, I guess, and those sorts of things. I mean,
it does, you know, access to altitude training. There's a list of, you know, potential things that advantage some people over others. So, yeah, and it's a thorny issue, I know. But, yeah, as I say, I'm of the view that it might actually do more harm to try to prevent these sorts of developments than to embrace them.
Are you taking some of the principles that you've used when you've worked with people like Kipchoge or Radcliffe and using them on your own ambitions for the marathon? Do you think that the everyday runner can take these principles, or actually are athletes in that caliber best off looked at as their own kind of thing, and actually the rest of us need to race and train in a completely different kind of way?
A bit of both. I think that, you know, you've got to dial it back. There are certainly lessons that you can learn from looking at the greats, but you can't, you know, there's no way I could run 100 or 120 miles a week anymore, even if I could have done it back in the day. So yeah, and especially when you get a bit older, one thing I've absolutely learned as I've, you know, continue to try to run over the decades is that you just got to be kinder on yourself. Absolutely. As you get a bit older, you become more susceptible to injury. You simply can't take the load and the speed as you used to. I mean, your bones and tendons and muscles seem to be much more prone to injury. So I've got to build in a lot more recovery than I used to. That's one of it. But, you know, that's certainly a lesson to be taken from the Kenyan approach. I had the opportunity with Nike to travel to spend some time you know, with Patrick Sang in Elliott's camp there. And the one thing that comes through very strongly is not only do they train, you know, pretty hard most of the time and certainly very consistently, but they, when they're not training, they really do relax. They enjoy one another's company, and they really know how to chill out. And they don't stick rigidly to a training formula either. And that's something as a science, you know, I really like to plan my training and I like to stick meticulously to it if I possibly can, you know, dot every I and cross every T. But what you have to appreciate is that you can't always stick to it. You have to be really flexible. You have to, it's that old adage, you've got to listen to your body. But it is absolutely true. And, you know, I don't think they really know exactly what they're going to do from one day to the next because it will be modified by Patrick according to how they responded and how they feel. So being a little bit looser in the way we structure our training is probably one of the lessons. And really the same with Paula. I mean, she used to quite often train as hard as she could for as many days in a row as she could, but she'd wake up one day and realize that she wasn't capable of really running at all that day. And rather than run a half-hearted session, she'd take a complete rest day. She wasn't afraid to do that. So it's really having the courage, having the confidence in your training. And that actually means not training harder and harder all the time and doing more and more. It sometimes means backing off. And they can do that. You know, I think that's perhaps a surprising lesson. It isn't necessarily the case that these great athletes always are training harder than the rest of us. They just train more sensibly.
It's very interesting, actually, because I think that the volume is very much seen as a success when it comes to training. And certainly people taking on marathons can fall victim to the notion of big mile weeks means I'm going to be able to achieve my PB. So it's quite nice to have that refreshing take that if you feel like you don't want to run a lot, that's also very, very achievable and you can do what you want. Why have you now decided to try to run a sub three? What's your motivation behind this ambition?
Yeah, part of it was because, you know, I enjoy training, I enjoy running, and once you get, you know, into your 40s and 50s, you're probably more than, you know, halfway through your life, and you've got to start to think about rather than performance, but also about health and longevity as well. So I wanted to do something that had me exercising, you know, regularly and enjoying it. And absolutely, you know, you can't run marathons unless you commit to your training program. But it also meant that you didn't have to train quite so intensely all of the time. You can, you know, run easily on some days, so that's good. The other attraction for the marathon for me was that I'd never run one before. Now, if you've run reasonably fast times at, you know, 1500 meters and 3K, 5K, 10K and the half marathon, you can't help but compare your terrible performances when you're in your 40s and 50s to what you're doing in your late teens and early 20s. So the good thing about the marathon was that I was bound to run a personal best. There was nothing to compare it against. So that was quite good. And I've run two already. I'd actually trained for a few and got various injuries and things and not made start lines. I actually started the Paris Marathon and only managed the first 5 miles because the cobblestones on the Champs-Élysées really irritated my soles of my feet, and my plantar fascia actually ruptured a few miles in, so I couldn't complete that one. But I did run the Sea of Galilee Marathon. When was that? About 18 months ago, I suppose. Really hot day. Struggled round in 3:34, and I knew that was way short of what I was capable of. Managed to prepare a bit better and ran Moscow last year and did 3:01, which I was pretty...
It's getting close.
Yeah, I know, 3:01, 3:30. And actually, it's quite a tough course, and it was extremely cold. It was the, you know, exact opposite of the Sea of Galilee race, which was blistering hot. This one was like about 2 degrees and hailstones and wind. So I thought, well, I can't leave it at 3:01. You know, sub three is certainly calling me. So I've entered for Amsterdam. I was supposed to do Prague in the spring, and that obviously got postponed and has since been postponed again. Amsterdam at present on October the 18th is still supposed to go ahead. I'd be kind of surprised if it does, but I've got to continue to prepare as if it happens. And if it doesn't, then obviously that training that I'll have done won't have been wasted, and I can roll it forward to whenever we're all able to come out hiding and compete again.
How have you been... How have you been managing with lockdown and training and keeping the sort of fitness there without overworking everything? Because I think that's been a big issue for a lot of runners, is the sort of, you know, keeping any sort of marathon fitness that they had for races, spring races, and sort of, you know, not letting it slide too much before the racing's allowed again.
Yeah, actually, a lot of the running that I do is on my treadmill. So I'm kind of fortunate in the basement of my house. I've kind of put a room aside that's a gym, and I've got a really nice treadmill in there. And most of my work's done on there. So, and actually, lockdown in some respects has been beneficial because I haven't been having to, you know, go off to work at 8 a.m. and get back 6 or 7 p.m. and then trying to fit some training around that. I've had the various, you know, Zoom and Teams meetings and all of that and various bits of academic work that I need to do. But it's been much more flexible in my day. I've been able to train, you know, 10 a.m. if I want, or 2 p.m. or whatever's appropriate. And it hasn't really been too much of an issue, I must admit. I've been able to be quite meticulous about that. So no issues from my perspective. And I like training on the treadmill just because it gives me that element of control. Doesn't mean that I train on it every day, but I think in terms of knowing exactly where you're at, it's there's something to look for it.
That's good. Did you sort of bring back your mileage, or have you sort of tried to keep it steady as you've sort of gone through the period? Did you have to adjust quite dramatically?
No, it's been around, probably averaged around 50 miles a week, I would say, something like that. What I haven't done up until this point is do the really long runs. What I did was a block of 5K training. I managed to get actually away on holiday last week, and the plan was to come back and then I'd have 10 weeks to Amsterdam, and that would be the very specific marathon training. So I'd start to do the, you know, the 15 milers and the 20 milers and such like. So in that phase, the idea was to get up into the, you know, 60 to 70 mile a week bracket. But I've actually quite enjoyed doing the, you know, I'm sort of going to be building the marathon endurance on top of a very specific speedy 5K. You know, unfortunately, I wasn't able to run a 5K in a park run or anything like that. But I think I was capable of running 17 something, which is the fastest I've been. Would have been able to do for quite a while. Though it's a bit embarrassing when you're doing your, you know, sprint intervals at 19 kilometers per hour, and then it dawns on you that you once ran a half marathon at a speed that was average quicker than that. So your sprint intervals are slower than your old half marathon pace. But anyway, you've got to take every success you can get.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'd like to talk to a scientist such as yourself about fueling, because I think that can be a topic of a kind of great debate among runners. Are you following the kind of carb-led approach that I feel like most elites follow, or do you think there's any merit in this kind of high-fat, low-carb approach?
I'm definitely a high-carb guy. I think if you're a very slow marathon runner, or if you're an ultra-endurance athlete, and I think I heard you talking about ultra-endurance when I just joined the call before we started the interview, then that's a different kettle of fish, really. I think there, you know, because the intensity is so much lower, then fat is fine. And, you know, training yourself to use fat as a fuel is probably the way forward. But when it comes to trying to run quickly over the marathon or at any shorter distance, then the most efficient fuel to use is carbohydrate. That will keep your oxygen uptake low, so it will you know, maintain your economy. And it's really important that you go into those events not only with lots of carbohydrate already within your muscles in the form of glycogen, but that you make every effort to take as much carbohydrate or, you know, reasonable amounts of carbohydrate into your system every hour as well. So, you should just about have enough carbohydrate to get you through a marathon if you go into it glycogen loaded and you take 60 or 70 grams per hour. And it's much better to do that because you know, that you'll be taking in the right fuel to run at the high intensities that you intend to sustain.
Will you be doing the, I know Morton, the gels or the drink is sort of favoured by, well, certainly by Kipchoge. I know it's, you know, Paula was competing before that stuff. Is that something that you're going to have a go at as well? Or have you got your own sort of hydration nutrition plan?
To be honest, I think there are a variety of different choices you can make. It depends really what you enjoy. The thing about the Morton products is they don't actually taste of anything, which for some people is a good thing. And for others, you know, you need something a little bit sweet just to kind of give you that lift as well. In Moscow, I used a combination of all sorts of different ones just to kind of keep me interested. I don't think there's actually any advantage to those newest gels and drinks compared to the ones that have been around for a few years, although they were kind of sold as having this, you know, new formula. The few studies that have been done don't seem to indicate that that's superior to, you know, your Gatorades and your Lucozades and whatever else, Powerade. So it's each to their own as far as that goes. The important thing is that you do avail yourself of the opportunity to take the fluids and the carbs on board.
I think another area that where you get sort of vastly differing views when it comes to marathon training is, I guess, the importance of weight training. We've had various people on, Andrew, over the last 3 years, and some would say all you got to do is run up a steep hill once a week really quickly. That will do for like strength training. And some people would say, actually, you know, you need to be lifting fairly heavy weights, ideally 3 times a week. I'd be interested to know yourself, having worked with the elite, what do they tend to do? Is there a kind of any generalizations that we could make about sort of strength and weight training with runners?
I don't think there's any real consensus on that, so I'm not surprised that you continue to have, you know, competing views on it. It's they all do a bit of it, but you know, the important thing is that it doesn't override your running training. I think it needs to supplement and complement what you do. I think then it's fine. It also depends a bit upon the type of runner that you are, as well as the event that you're training for. I mean, you clearly need to have sufficient strength at shorter distances. When it comes to the marathon, less so. But the type of training that can be beneficial there is things like the plyometric work, which can improve running economy, that sort of thing. I don't think you need to be lifting particularly heavy weights. If you're not a very strong person, then it probably wouldn't hurt to supplement what you do. But the important thing is you have to remember that every training session that you do, whether it's running or weight training or whatever, takes something out of you. So you have to be, you know, it's all about the balance. And if the weight training that you do doesn't drain your energy resources and mean that you don't get maximum out of your running training sessions, then fine, go ahead. But if it takes time, a lot of time, let's say if you're doing an hour 3 times a week, and that's cutting into the time that you should otherwise spend running, or you're so tired or sore that you can't run a good long run or interval training session, then it might well mean that you're doing too much. You know, so Paula used to do a couple of weight training sessions per week, and you know, I think did enough. It wasn't enough to compromise the endurance work that she was doing. That was really important. Elliot, they don't do much when they're in their specific marathon training block. They do some conditioning, so they recover after the most recent marathon that they've done. They start to do some easy running. They start to do some conditioning and some body weight exercises and that sort of thing. And they do maintain the core strength exercises. That's something that's changed over the last couple of years. But there's no weight training facility in camp. So when they're doing their final, whatever it is, 10 to 12 weeks of marathon training, they really don't do a lot of weights. But what they do, of course, is run over a lot of undulating terrain. And I was talking to some physios who've worked with some of the leading East African runners, and it's absolutely the case that if you look at their feet and their lower legs, they're extremely muscular. They've got, you know, muscles on their feet that you didn't know existed. And I think that's partly because they're barefoot a lot of the time, but the terrain over which they run is really rugged. You know, it's up and down, but it's side to side, and it's in quite often in heavy mud as well. So in a sense, they're doing a fair bit of resistance training while they run. So that bit you mentioned about, you know, would it be sufficient to run up and down hills? Well, in part, although I know some strength and conditioning colleagues who would argue against that. And, you know, I think there is some room for inclusion of plyometric type weight training activities as well, just to augment the running economy adaptations.
Hmm. That's really interesting. That's what I imagined. But I think some people perhaps, yeah, they can think, they can want the weight stuff to make more of a difference than it actually does, because it's in some way an easier sell to go and lift some weights rather than, I don't know, run more or run up and down loads of hills. That can be quite a hard sell, I think, for some people.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. And, you know, the other argument that's put forward for weight training is that it can maybe reduce, you know, injury risk, and maybe there's something in there. But yeah, I agree with you that, you know, doing some is probably a good thing, but you've got to absolutely make sure that you don't do too much. It will never be a substitute for the running itself.
I wanted to ask you quickly about mental strength, because, you know, when you see Kipchoge running, we were talking about looking at Cheptegei doing the 5,000 meter world record, and it's so serene, and it looks kind of, it can look a bit effortless, but I'm guessing that, well, I'm sure that his capacity to push himself, same with Paula, is actually far beyond what most people could ever imagine. Has that been your experience of working with these people? Actually, their capacity for pain is really like hugely impressive.
Yeah, I think so. They certainly do know how to push themselves, but I don't think it's expressed in their running form to the same extent. So, you know, I used to be consultant physiologist to British Athletics or to UK Athletics. So I used to accompany some of our runners up to various altitude training camps, and we went to Kenya on a few occasions. And it's really interesting when you watch groups of Kenyans and groups of Brits do their track sessions, for example. I'm certain that they're working equally as hard, and yet when you watch the Brits finish their reps, their form falls to pieces. You can tell their fatigue just by looking at their stride and their, you know, their upper body, and the running economy or the running form of the Kenyans doesn't seem to deteriorate to anything like the same extent. So there's something about that. I'm sure they're hurting just as much, and they're working just as hard. But for some reason, it doesn't seem to impact on their running form to the same extent. I mean, the one thing talking about psychology that I'll say about Kipchoge, with my experience of you know, the Breaking 2 project in particular, was that of all the athletes that we tested and that we selected, he was probably, I think, the only one that genuinely believed that it was possible. You know, so he had an unwavering, unshakable belief and confidence in his own ability and in his own coaching and training and his preparations, and he dares to think beyond, you know, what the current limits are. And that's hard to do. You know, we see world records. We saw it just a few days ago in the 5K, that world records tend to fall by 1 or 2, you know, 2 seconds is a lot, 1 or 2 or fractions of a second at a time. But to blow it completely out of the water in the way that he did, I think takes a different mindset as well. And he clearly has that.
Are you trying to sort of adopt some of that on a more everyday level with breaking 3 hours? Do you think actually you really need to believe that you can do it, and that there's that challenge for people as well?
Yes, in part. Yeah, I mean, I think you do sort of need to dare to dream. I have to be careful here because I'm on shaky territory, because I'm a physiologist, not a psychologist.
And,
I do believe that we do have our limits. I love Elliot's slogan of no human is limited, but my job as a physiologist is to determine exactly where those limits are. And I think everybody does have their limits. There's no point you or I thinking we could break 2. We could dream as much as we like, but we haven't got the equipment to achieve it. So you have to make sure your dreams are realistic as well as challenging. But yeah, I kind of agree that if we put our minds to it, dare to dream and prepare accordingly, that we can probably all achieve a little bit more than we might expect. And that's what I'm hoping is true in this this sub-3 challenge that I've undertaken for myself.
Definitely. Have you thought about where the human limit might be? I mean, obviously Kipchoge has shown that it's lower than some people, or higher than some people thought it was. Do you get a sense there is a kind of upper limit to where we can get up to in the marathon?
I think it's you know, when you see him run 1:58.40 in Vienna, and actually that didn't look like he was especially stretched. Actually, he came over to I'm at the University of Exeter, and we gave him an honorary doctorate last Christmas. And one of the things we asked him at lunch was, you know, how hard was it? Could you have gone faster? And he was like, it wasn't that hard. I could have gone a lot faster. So,
wow.
Yeah. And I, you know, people say, well, it was all about the manufactured course and such like, and maybe it'll never happen in London or Berlin. But I wouldn't be surprised if it did. I think if he, especially if he had a bit of competition in the shape of Bekele, and he was able to draft a little bit longer, I wouldn't be, my mind wouldn't be blown if sub two was achieved on a regular marathon course, and perhaps Elliott. Or I mean, to be honest, I think the athletes that are coming out of Uganda at the moment are incredible as well. So the fact that 1:58 has now occurred, I think we'll see sub two happen again in other competitions before very long, and you know, people will target, because we know now what's humanly possible. People will target those new times, and I think we'll see not only greater depth of incredible performances, which we're already seeing, but there'll be somebody, the new Kipchoge will emerge from probably somewhere in East Africa, but take it to another level again.
Do you think that there is, because everyone, we always talk about Kipchoge as the sort of the perfect example of running, but is there actually, are there minute, they must be minute, faults within his physical biomechanics that actually there is still room for improvement in terms of how a human moves?
Yeah, there would be. What was a little bit unfortunate about the work that we did with Elliott and the other athletes actually prior to the first breaking two attempt in Monza was that when we tested them both in the lab and on the field, they weren't necessarily in their best condition. I mean, some of the numbers that they were producing for VO2 max and, you know, lactate threshold and running economy was still incredible. But in and of themselves, each one of those numbers wasn't the best that's ever been recorded. Do you know what I mean? So it was really a combination of those three things that's important, I think, in achieving what they do. The other thing that we're unable to measure in the lab, you know, let's say somebody comes to the lab for an hour and you do a test, you can measure the various parameters of various variables that we think are important to success when they get to the start line. But the other thing is that you have to remember that those variables all change the dynamic as the marathon progresses. So whereas somebody, let's say my VO2 max or my lactate threshold and certainly my running economy will get worse. If you measured me after 2 hours of my 3 hour marathon run, you know, the numbers that you would get then would be very different to what they were on the start line. I suspect that in people like Elliott, they probably, you know, they just don't deteriorate to the same extent. They've got incredible fatigue resistance, and that's something that we're not able to measure. So, I think that's that fourth dimension that nobody really ever gets to talk about that is really what makes those guys really special. When we measured Kipchoge at the time that we measured him, his numbers, while they were certainly right up there, they were amongst the best that we measured, they weren't necessarily the best of the lot, and that's partly because he wasn't in his best condition. I have no doubt in my mind that were we able to test all of the athletes in their best condition, or if you could measure Kipchoge a few days before he was, you know, ran a marathon in his best condition, that his physiology numbers would be the best in the world. I have no doubt about that. But you know, at the time that we measured him, they weren't. But he knows how to get into that condition, and I think it's the whole package, both with him and whoever comes to supersede what he's achieved in the future, that it's really important.
Andrew, it's so good to talk to you about marathon running, and we wish you all the best, hopefully at Amsterdam, when you to break in the 3 hour, but if not there, then definitely somewhere else. I'm sure you can do it. You've done 3:01, so you're so close.
Very close, yeah. It's just an extra few seconds per mile, isn't it? Yeah, hopefully it'll happen in Amsterdam, but if not, then it'll have to be next year, won't it? But let's keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah, well, look, thanks again for making the time to speak with us on the Runner's World podcast. It was really, really great to get your insights on the marathon, you know, for the elites, but also for the kind of the everyday runner as well. So we really appreciate you coming on.
That's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
That brings us to the end of this week's Runner's World podcast. A huge thanks to our guest, Dr. Andrew Jones, and of course to you for listening. The Runner's World podcast is available on Acast, iTunes, Spotify and all of your favourite podcast apps. Just search Runner's World UK and click subscribe. Thanks again for listening and we will see you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavourless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.